Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Presidential Leadership, The Defining Traits. Recorded in early 2025, host Jim Falk sits down with presidential historians Talmadge Boston, author of How the Best Did It, Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents, and Jeremy Suri, PhD, Mack Brown Distinguished Professor at UT Austin, and author of The Impossible Presidency, along with John Lawrence, PhD, former Chief of Staff to Nancy Pelosi, and author of Arc of Power, to discuss what separates history's most effective presidents from the rest. The conversation points to common threads among the best, building a strong team, staying open to opposing views, and learning from past mistakes. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
As we approach the inauguration of the 47th American president, it's an ideal time to reflect on past leaders and consider which of them are remembered as the most successful. What defining character traits and skills made these presidents stand out? I'm Jim Falk. Thanks so much for watching today's program. To discuss this and much more, we have an all-star panel. Coming to us from Washington, D.C. is John Lawrence. For 38 years, Dr. Lawrence was a senior congressional staff member serving from 2005 to 2013 as chief of staff to Nancy Pelosi. He's a visiting professor at the University of California's Washington Center, where he teaches about Congress and contemporary American politics, and is the author of a book I really enjoyed, Arc of Power, Inside Nancy Pelosi's Speakership. Dr. Jeremy Suri, he's a frequent guest of the program. He's a presidential historian at the University of Texas at Austin, where he is the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy. He's the author and editor of several books, but one that is of particular interest for this conversation, it's The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Here in the studio is Talmadge Boston, a lawyer and presidential historian. Mr. Boston is the author of How the Best Did It, Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents, which was published just a few months ago. He's also a contributing columnist to the Dallas Morning News. Great to have all of you with us. So, Jeremy, I'm going to give you an easy layup. You're going to like this question. Talmadge identifies that a characteristic of the presidents is among the best is that they devoted time to studying history, learning from their predecessors' accomplishments and their failures. So why is it so important for not just presidents, but for all of us to care about history?
I think Talmadge has hit the nail on the head here, as he often does with his astute analysis. I think what's absolutely crucial is that the presidency is a unique job. There's no way to prepare for that job except to see what the few people who have done it before you, and it's a very few, what they have dealt with, the stresses, the obligations of the office, the management of this huge thing called the United States, the various international and domestic obligations. And so one can be prepared for many jobs by studying technical skills, by being exposed to different experiences, but there's nothing like the presidency. And so the best way anyone can prepare to really have a sense of what they're getting into is to look at what their predecessors dealt with. And I agree 100% with Talmadge that the presidents who have fared the best are the ones who have thought deeply about how their predecessors struggled with unsolvable problems, with impossible tasks, and how they could perhaps move the ball forward just a little bit based on the knowledge of what their predecessors had done before them.
So let's talk a little bit about the rankings. Talmadge, you have your own ranking, and I'm going to ask our other guests to give me their sense and see if they agree with you. But in your book, you drew very heavily on C-SPAN's ranking. Who's the top?
Lincoln, number one. Washington, number two. FDR, three. Theodore Roosevelt, four. Eisenhower, five. Truman, six. Jefferson, seven. Kennedy, eight. And Reagan, nine. So the only adjustment that I made to the C-SPAN ranking, and that ranking has been the same in the last two C-SPAN polls, 2017 and 2021. I think Truman's overrated. He got us into Korea and had no idea how to get us out. He had no idea how to deal with McCarthyism and the Red Scare. He gets a lot of credit for dropping the A-bombs and bringing a prompt into World War II.
John, do you agree with this ranking?
Well, I think we could, you know, we can agree and disagree with certain individual people and where they might rank. Part of, I think, the issue of how to decide who is a successful president is what kind of success they have with their moving their legislative program. And some presidents there have been more successful than others. In that particular case, for example, you would have to put Lyndon Johnson pretty high on the list, notwithstanding the fact that he was driven from office through a great deal of public and party discomfort over Vietnam, justifiably. But in terms of his ability to both manage Congress before the landslide in 1964 and pass long-stalled legislation, particularly the civil rights legislation, and then after, in that short window of opportunity, they had this vast, great society, I would say you'd have to give him very high a role. And I might put him higher than a couple of other people on that list. I would also say that one of the characteristics that's really crucial for a successful president in almost all cases, and we can get into this later if you like, is being able to develop a close working relationship with the Congress. I think that in general, historians, journalists are excessively interested in the presidency to the degree that they diminish the critical role that the Congress plays in the legislative process. And while presidents can try to govern through executive orders and can rarely generate the kind of supermajority support for major legislation, it's only when they have a solid working understanding of the relationship between the executive and the legislative branch that you see the kind of success.
Somehow, I'm not surprised that you said that, given the fact that you worked on the Hill for 40 years. So, Jeremy, I remember being at an event here in Dallas a few years ago with three or four of your esteemed colleagues. And a question was asked, which president is underrated? And the answer they gave was George H.W. Bush. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think George H.W. Bush is one of a number of underrated presidents, but I fully agree. If you look at the ways in which George H.W. Bush managed transformation of the international system, he was not necessarily the driving force for that. That was more Gorbachev and others. But Bush was able to manage that in a peaceful, consensual way. And then the way he built a truly international coalition to conduct a war to remove Saddam Hussein's aggression in Kuwait, but yet not to overstretch the United States into taking on an occupation that we later learned, as he predicted, would not be one that we would succeed at. I think you have to give him very, very high marks. He suffered, I think, when he ran for re-election, not that from doing a bad job, but from a different set of expectations and priorities that people had after the Cold War. Just as Winston Churchill could win World War II and be voted out of office, George H.W. Bush, in some ways, was there when the United States came out of the Cold War somewhat triumphant. And then as the public turned to different issues, he seemed like less the president they wanted, but that does not diminish his accomplishment.
You know, Talmadge, one of the things that I think is interesting about these lists and the ranking is the fluidity. You might be ranked dead last and sometimes be reelected. Why do people go up and down in the list?
Well, the historians are voting in real time, and so many times they're voting on the basis of their social consciousness, 21st century social consciousness. And so people like Woodrow Wilson, who later we learn was a horrible racist, or Andrew Jackson, who did bad things to Native Americans, once history knows more about all those facts, it influences today's historians to view them lower. On the other hand, Ulysses Grant, who for years was rated one of our worst presidents, history realized this guy did a pretty good job in Reconstruction and bringing an end to lynchings and doing what a great president would do to try to put African-Americans in the best possible position in the aftermath of the Civil War.
And Drs. Lawrence and Suri, both of you are in classrooms with students. How do you respond when a student comes up and says, well, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, they had slaves? John, how do you, I mean, this whole issue about presentism in your field?
Well, of course, I mean, one of the challenges for any historian is to try to see the past as the people in the past saw it, rather than being judgmental and applying contemporary standards. So I get that all the time, not only with respect to the founding fathers, but certainly to the framing of the Constitution, the whole design of American government, which, if you look at the Electoral College and the Senate in particular, are all designed to, in some part, prevent majoritarian rule and in the context of the 1780s, protect the institution of slavery. I don't think it's necessary to whitewash American history in order to say that, in order to get an accurate history, or in order to even be considered positive about the long thrust of American history. And I try to get students to abandon this notion that if you can prove there was something untoward about the values early on, then somehow or other that justifies the kind of critique that you sometimes hear from undergraduates.
Jeremy, how do you approach it?
Similar. I think the point we try to make as historians to our readers and to students is that everyone is a product of their context, of the moment that they live in. We certainly are, and my children point this out to me all the time when they find my moral failings that reflect the moment I grew up in. I'm a Yankees fan. I grew up in New York City. That's a moral failing I have in the eyes of many people, right? But that's where I came from. So we judge people relative to the context that they are in. So George Washington, I think the question of slavery actually reflects well on him. Here is a man who at the end of his life did all he could to manumit, to free at least the slaves that he owned, not the ones that his wife owned, but the ones that he owned. And that shows that, yes, he benefited from chattel slavery during his entire life. The servant who helped to serve all the people who came to visit him at Mount Vernon was a slave, for example. But this was a man who in his own time was still trying to change the system and move the system forward in a way to reach a higher moral vision. But it was not possible for him to eliminate slavery in his time. That does not apologize for slavery in any way. As Dr. Lawrence said, we should not whitewash the past, but we should not judge people based on our standards today. We should judge them based on the standards of their own time that they live in.
Do you feel that this is largely the consensus of your colleagues and counterparts in your field?
Yes, I do. I think the challenge is those who are not historians, who are pontificating as if they were historians, on both sides of the aisle. There are those on one side who want to throw away Thomas Jefferson because he owned slaves. And of course, that to me is throwing away a key part of our historical founding and the principles upon which we are based. But then there are those on the other side who want to tell a history without slavery and want to pretend that this was not there and pretend that Thomas Jefferson was not torn apart by his dependence on slavery when he himself saw it as a moral crime. And so we as historians have to take ourselves back to the dilemmas of the moment that people are in, because that's what helps us deal with our dilemmas today. I am deeply shattered, as you are, Jim, by the people around the world today who are suffering from genocide and suffering from impoverishment. But I cannot blame American leaders for not solving those problems. But I can ask American leaders to be attentive to those problems. And that's the same way I think we think about historical actors. Do they recognize the problems and dilemmas of their time, and how do they struggle with them? That struggle is what's interesting for us.
Talmadge, in the book, How the Best Did It, there were some instances and anecdotes and stories you told that surprised me. I guess I haven't read enough biographies on George Washington. I was surprised how, in a sense, unsuccessful and unpopular he was early in his career. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, a trait of the great leaders is they learn from their mistakes. And so Washington was a very prominent American soldier in the American colonies fighting for the British Army during the French and Indian War. And he was a very ambitious guy. And so as he would exhibit so many acts of bravery, he kept thinking he should be promoted. And he would reach out to his superiors. Come on, give me a promotion. Give me a change in my rank. Give me some recognition. And he always got rebuffed and turned down. He learned his lesson, and he's famous thereafter from the French and Indian War of always making sure he never tried to promote himself. He let other people be the ones to pick him to be the chairman of the Constitutional Convention, to be the chairman or to be commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the Revolution, to be our first president. He was never promoting himself because he learned those lessons early on from the French and Indian War.
Another president that gets, of course, justifiably a lot of attention is Abraham Lincoln for being able to bring in a different team. And, of course, we all remember and probably read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals. How unique was Lincoln in that regard, John?
Well, I think he was. There was always efforts, and you heard it just in this most recent campaign, to demonstrate your bipartisanship by saying you'd bring somebody into the cabinet Kennedy famously did that. Obama did that with Ray LaHood and others. But I think what's unique about Abraham Lincoln was the time in which he was doing it, where the people that he was bringing into the cabinet were not just people who were friendly rivals, but these are people who had very different visions of what the country was and what had to be done in order to keep the country together. And so in that respect, and I think this is why Lincoln finds himself at the top of almost every list, he was dealing with an existential question about the survivability of the nation, not just dealing with a policy disagreement or a war where the country came together, even though it was a traumatic experience. He was dealing with the very issue of survivability, and he wasn't afraid to put people into high levels of government who had run against him and had, and in other, in some cases like Chase, continued to be strong critics of his through the course of his administration.
I wonder if it's not harder for presidents to do that now in this era that we're living in with hyper-partisanship.
It's more difficult to find people who are trustworthy enough to carry out your agenda when there's such alignment of the parties and hostility between the parties. It would have been interesting theoretically had Harris been elected in the last election. She had a large number of Republicans who had, some of whom had served in the Trump administration, some of whom had not, but who had walked away from the Trump administration. They hadn't become liberal Democrats, people like Liz Cheney. Would they have found a role in a Harris administration so that you could have tried to start building back some public trust in bipartisanship? Or would it have been a largely symbolic nomination of one or two people to somewhat marginal cabinet positions? Of course, we're never going to know that.
So one thing that when you think about the presidents that are on the list, they were challenged by very difficult situations, whether it was the first president, the founding of the nation, Abraham Lincoln with the Civil War, FDR with World War II,
Depression.
Reagan with the Cold War. So my question to you, Jeremy, is that sort of a sign that presidents grow into the role? And in a sense, were they helped by the fact that they were put in a precarious situation?
This was always Bill Clinton's lament, right? That he didn't have a big enough issue that he could use to really make himself into this great president that he certainly had the talent to become. But he's not on the list of the top 10, and he knows it. And that's part of the challenge. I do think that the circumstances that one lives in do at times put more emphasis and give more attention to presidential leadership. Another way of putting that is that certain crises allow presidents the space to lead in the way they couldn't otherwise lead. So much of what Franklin Roosevelt did, for example, he would not have been able to do if he had been elected in 1920 when he first ran as vice president, and the country was in a very different situation. There would not have been a New Deal, and there would not have been a World War II. That does not diminish the extraordinary leadership that I think we all agree that he showed in that extraordinarily difficult decade and a half that he was in the White House. But it is to say that the difficulties of that decade gave him the opportunity to showcase what he could do, and he certainly grew into that office. But not all presidents grow into the office. Lyndon Johnson, who Professor Lawrence mentioned before, Lyndon Johnson, I think, was an incredibly successful domestic president and incredibly successful in his legislative program. But the problem, of course, as Professor Lawrence pointed out, right, is that Johnson did not grow into the foreign policy role in managing the Vietnam War. And so not every president grows into the role when the crises emerge for them.
And I would suggest that George W. Bush was in that same situation. He really came into the office wanting to be the domestic president, and international events certainly made that prohibited. Talmadge, two presidents that come to mind as being eternal optimists were both faced with some tough situations in their life. FDR, getting polio at what age? Late 30s, is that right?
39.
And people may be surprised, but Ronald Reagan had a very difficult childhood, which affected him. And yet both of these men were known for their optimism. And we've seen presidents who have not been optimistic. I would think of Jimmy Carter as one, and perhaps President-elect Trump. But why is optimism so important?
Well, personal optimism is a great thing, but the key is, can you inspire optimism in the American public? That's, if you can, like FDR could, like Reagan could, then you're going to surge. You're going to win your elections in landslides. FDR won all four elections by over 80%. Reagan, Carter, I think, got five or six states. Mondale got one state. So when you're getting almost the entire American people to believe in what your priorities are and what your game plans are, then you're going to thrive typically, unless there's some disastrous occurrence like Iran-Contra in Reagan's case. But for the most part, optimists are what make good things happen. Pessimists almost never make good things happen.
John, when you think about messaging, and you and I have had many conversations on this, which president do you feel really understood that? And of course, situations change because one president's working with the radio and another one may be internet and social media.
I would say if you look historically, the person who used messaging, I would say the most effectively was FDR, because he took hold of the new medium of radio, and he used that in effect to introduce himself. Remember, I think the first radio broadcast, you guys can correct me, I think it was KDK, maybe 1920 or something like that, certainly the first presidential coverage. Many people did not even have radios until the late 1920s, 1930s. So most of the country had never heard a president's voice, had never seen a president. And so they were dependent upon broadsheets and newspapers to effectively get to know their president. They didn't have airplanes. They didn't have even trains for much of the country's history. So here Roosevelt took hold of a new mechanism for communication and used it to not only to introduce himself, but to soothe the nation through an incredibly difficult period by being able to assume that kind of responsibility, sort of the father of the nation. I would put him very, very high on that list in terms of communicating. I think that Reagan was particularly unique as well. And I think a lot of that comes from his background, which of course many people, particularly Democrats, mocked going into the presidency. But Reagan, as Max Boot's book points out most recently, Reagan was didn't pretend that he was a policy expert. He was the guy who was selling the policies to the American people. And he was able to do that through the regular weekly broadcast, through his ease at public speaking. I remember very late in his presidency, a reporter said to him, "Well, do you think it was a problem being an actor before you were president?" And his answer was, "I don't see how anybody could do this job who wasn't an actor." And particularly in an age of the kind of telecommunications we have now, not to mention social media, that kind of ability to connect with people is as important as the intricacies of the messages that you're sending.
Well, to follow up on John's point, what FDR was to the radio, John F. Kennedy was to television. He was the first great television president. Those Nixon-Kennedy debates on television, his important speeches, inaugural address, Rice Stadium, his televised address on civil rights. He used television to get the American people behind him, the first and foremost. Since then, obviously, Reagan was very good on television. But Kennedy, I think, set the standard. His press conferences, go watch those YouTubes of his press conferences. He was a master.
Oh, well, especially when you listen to the debates. I mean, he was so strong. And yet, remember, Nixon, some people said who listened on the radio felt that Nixon won. Talmadge, in your book, you talk about some of the key traits that you've identified on your eight presidents. Give me three or four of them and why you think they're important.
Well, obviously, trait number one is integrity. George Washington's chapter one, and he was a man of great integrity. Therefore, you have credibility. Whenever you speak, people don't have to read the newspaper the next day to fact check you. They know they can take your words to the bank. Of course, that was true of Lincoln as well, and both the Roosevelts. So integrity in this day and time, particularly consensus building. We are a divided nation. Our American history, so many times we've been divided, and the great presidents find ways to cross the aisle. Reagan gets the Reagan Democrats. Clinton was so successful at bringing Republicans to his side, as was Kennedy. And so I think those are the two traits that stand out. Getting back to Jeremy's point, this is a uniquely difficult job. If you don't have integrity, it's really hard to lead because people can't trust you. And if you aren't able to work with both sides of the aisle, then government probably isn't going to work very well.
And what about some of the flaws you've identified? Because in your book, this is very interesting because you don't often see it written this way. you have their positive traits, and then everyone had some negative.
Right. Our mutual friend, Mark Updegrove, was the one when I was starting this book said, no, you got to have a section on flaws. On
now, who is he?
Mark Updegrove, former head of the LBJ Library, currently the head of the LBJ Foundation, who's a wonderful presidential biographer. His most recent biography is on John F. Kennedy. But anyway, he said, no, you got to have flaws. You got to complete the picture, what Ken Burns calls emotional archaeology. And so Reagan, for example, obviously was not a detail guy. Thank goodness he had James Baker as his White House chief of staff, who was the ultimate detail guy who kept Reagan from making any big mistakes in his first term. And both Ronald and Nancy Reagan in their memoirs said if he'd been chief of staff for his second term, there never would have been Iran-Contra. Obviously, we've talked about the flaws associated with Thomas Jefferson, his blind spot on slavery, his relationship with Sally Hemings. And so they're real-life human beings. In many cases, under certain circumstances, they have feet of clay, but they did great things. And that's what the book's about. There are so many things we can learn from their great leadership that we can also learn from avoiding their flaws.
John, you've worked with a number of presidents. Excuse me. Who do you think was really the most effective at working with both houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate? Who understood how important it was?
It's a really important question because some people will come to the presidency with a long background in the legislative process, like a Lyndon Johnson or a John Kennedy or George H.W. Bush. Others like George W. Bush or Reagan or Carter come in with virtually no experience. And establishing a credible relationship with your people and with the opposition in Congress is really important. I point to George W. Bush, who for all his problems that he had in his presidency, had the wisdom to extend very close relationships with the speaker and with the staff.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Very interesting. And you all have the right careers because it's certainly a fascinating topic. You know, I think that every new president steps into the Oval Office with the hope of one day joining the ranks of the nation's list to be the best. However, given the high bar set by those who achieve this distinction, I think we'll all agree it's not an easy task. Today's discussion reminds us that there are common threads shared by the best presidents. Building a strong team, as you mentioned, being open to opposing views and learning from past mistakes. Not bad advice for anyone aspiring to be president of the United States or maybe even your local PTA. Thanks so much for watching our program where we talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.